because you get so much dopamine release.
You crave it and you depend on it.
Not just crave it, you depend on it, but your body is drained out of it.
Right.
Right? And then you just, like, you know, it's like, have you seen this withdrawal symptoms when a person quits smoking?
Right.
And the first few days,
from
like,
a curled circuit quitting.
You talk to them and they blow in your face.
Right.
Same thing. So we live kind of in this world where all these things have drained us and we don't have. So what I say is, like, to create a bit of sense of a quietness and serenity in the house, turn off everything, turn off all these devices,
right,
and have a bit of quiet time. You know, sometimes I turn off the power and I put a few candles just to have that kind of comfort where I have nothing.
Right.
It's
right.
Kind of relaxing. It's, you know, for 5-10 minutes, it gives you a bit. So as a family, try to turn off everything and just have a family time together.
Right. So eliminate the things that are stressful.
That creates stress itself. That right. create pressure itself. And like I'm telling you, these things create a lot of pressure. Now, not to even mention the psychological effect that you get about the things that you're already seeing anyway.
Right.
Because everything
yeah.
that you see, obviously not everything is innocent. So right. a lot of things actually play a big role, and they deliberately
right.
trying to mess up with your mind. So
right.
that will create even more points. So I'm saying, you know what? Turn everything off. Go out for a walk. Go to the park. Enjoy nature. Do something as a family without all these distractions.
Right.
Release all your pressure, right? Don't stay in the house and constantly be there. Even though I think I remember a study done way back about TV itself. It, you know, when you put TV, it emits all these rays.
Right.
They said always keep a door open or a window open. So there's constantly the air is refreshed. Because if these rays gets emitted from the TV, it creates a sense of pressure. A person becomes always pressured and nervous and
right.
what have you. So turn them off. Go for a walk, go to the park, have family time, have a quiet time, enjoy yourselves. At least you get to have this bit of release instead of just, constantly being agitated. And also have, you know, have a bit of practice here and there, do a bit of exercise and so on and so forth.
Dear Sayyid, I will unfortunately have to interrupt you because we are out of time for today's program. Dear Sayyid, I thank you for your time and for your insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If the dear listeners have any questions or other relevant comments and feedback, please contact us at our email englishradio@irib.ir. You can also visit our website parstoday.com. Alternatively, you can also find us on the various social media accounts we have on YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in. Until next time, fi amanillah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight. A petition of nearly 300 people have been flooded, and their advocates argue that the U.S. federal government's current flood insurance policies are inadequate for an era of climate crisis. We now present you an article concerning this issue written by Oliver Millman. The piece is titled, Everything is at Risk, Flood Survivors Urge U.S. Congress to Change Inadequate Insurance. With towns and cities across the United States increasingly deluged by ferocious storms and rising sea levels, a group of disaster survivors has pleaded with the federal government to overhaul a flood insurance system they say is ill-equipped for an era of climate crisis. A petition of nearly 300 people who have been flooded and their advocates is set to be sent to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, to call for a drastic overhaul of the government-run flood insurance system that underwrites most flood policies in the United States. The petition, organized by Anthropocene Alliance, an environmental nonprofit, reads, "We've lived without electricity, running water, and secure shelter. We've heard our children cry from the absence of friends, school, and safety. And we've confronted homelessness, illness, and mind-numbing red tape from insurance companies and government agencies." The survivors are calling for a ban on irresponsible housing development in flood-prone areas, new rules that would provide buyers with the present and future flood risks of a property before purchasing it, and a greater focus on relocating communities and elevating properties away from flood water rather than simply funding rebuilding flooded homes in the same place as before. Stephen Eiselman, Director of Strategy at Anthropocene Alliance, said, "To continue to build in vulnerable places does not make sense and needs to come to a halt. A lot of people are suckered into buying in these places because there's no federal disclosure laws. This is turning into a crisis, especially for poorer people." Stephen Eisenman added, "We are beginning to see the start of a great American flood migration, and that exodus is only going to accelerate in the next decade. To keep building in these areas is just crazy." Particular controversy is a process called fill and build, where developers heap soil upon flood-prone areas, elevating them slightly before building housing upon the compacted dirt. Critics say this simply diverts floodwater to neighbors and is a short-term fix to a chronic problem. Amber Bismack, a petition signatory who lives in Livingston County, Michigan, which is part of Detroit's metropolitan area, said, "We have developers building on wetland areas that can't hold water anymore, so it just flows off onto us." Amber Bismack moved to the area close to a tributary of the Huron River 7 years ago and has seen her neighborhood flooded on 15 occasions. "The flooding has become so bad at times that Bismack has had to don waders to carry her children home through floodwater. The family have had to temporarily move out of the house, too, when the drains stopped working because of the flooding." She said that the worsening floods are taking its toll on the local community. Amber Bismack, who is part of a community group that is calling for Congress to mandate flood risk disclosure to all potential home buyers, says, "I can't tell you how much depression we're seeing in the community because it just floods over and over again. We've seen a real decline in people's mental health." She added, "I know someone who thought their flood insurance would be $1,000 a year, but couldn't find out the true risk until they bought, and it was deemed by FEMA to be high risk with a premium of $13,000 a year, which is unlivable. People are just stuck. The National Flood Insurance Scheme was launched in 1968 and has become the default for millions of Americans unable to get mortgages without flood insurance, which is routinely denied by private providers. However, the system has been driven into debt, with some homes repeatedly rebuilt in the same place only to be flooded again. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, deems homes at risk if they're in something called the 100-year floodplain, which means they have a 1% risk each year of getting a foot of water in flooding. However, this system does not account for the proximity to water or the unfolding climate crisis, meaning that many of the flood maps are inaccurate and premiums do not reflect the actual risk of flooding. Jackie Jones, a resident of Reidsville, Georgia, a town that often floods following heavy rainfall, said, "The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, is a joke. It doesn't update its flood maps. I wouldn't have bought this house if I knew I'd get so much water. But based on FEMA's maps, there's no flooding here. They need to step up and take some control." In October, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, unveiled a new system called Risk Rating 2.0 that aims to address a situation where nearly half of the flood claims received by FEMA are from people outside zones where insurance is required. Around three-quarters of the 4.9 million federal insurance policyholders will pay more for their premiums. David Morstad, a senior executive of the National Flood Insurance Program, told Associated Press, "We've learned that the old way of looking at risk has lots of gaps which understated the property's flood risk and communicated a false sense of security. The elevated premiums have been opposed by some members of Congress who argue it will hurt people who require affordable housing. But Eisenman says the reforms do not go far enough, as they do not actually curb new building on risky floodplains." Eisenman said, "Much more profound changes are needed. Instances of nuisance flooding, where high tides exacerbated by sea level rise cause streets and homes to fill with water, have increased dramatically along U.S. coastlines in recent years, and more powerful storms fueled by a heating atmosphere are bringing heavier bursts of rainfall to parts of the country. Research has found rising sea levels alone could force around 13 million Americans to relocate by the end of the century. However, for many people, moving is not an option due to financial constraints or ties to home." Rebecca Jim, who lives in the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma, says, "There is a great concern and fear because everything is at risk, even people's lives." Miami, a city in the area, has been regularly flooded by water that washes toxins from a nearby mining site onto homes, schools, and businesses. Rebecca Jim says, "It's foolish and criminal that more building is allowed on floodplains, but much of what is flooded here is tribal land, and people here aren't moving from that."
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
Allah.
humanity. Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio. And you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi as-salam, and especially the justice of Ali alayhi as-salam. It is very important when we look at the justice of Ali alayhi as-salam is to look at the time of Ali alayhi as-salam. During the last days of the Khilafah of Uthman, and those who were in power who were appointed by him, and especially the members of the Umayyad family, who were the kinsmen and relatives of the Khalifa himself, had made it a practice that they openly opposed the Islamic rule and regulations. They humiliated people, treated them like slaves, and made them so much afraid of the rule that they could not pick up the courage to stand before him and mention their grievance. They played with their lives in the same manner in which they played with their property. They did not refrain from shedding the blood of the people for their personal benefits, and no one could dare take revenge. That was just a historical fact. They were not afraid of taking bribes or looting the property of other people. Their continuous activities and conditions and circumstances showed that their intentions were very clear, that they were going to be oppressors, and they would, you know, have the blood and the lives of the people in their hand. And such an action and acts that were committed by the Umayyad family, especially at the last, were the months or weeks of the rule of Uthman, the Muslims were outraged. They were in uproar. And if you read the books of history, you see that the house of Uthman itself was surrounded by the Muslims. They would try to come into the house and kill him, and which they did eventually, because they could not stand the corruption. It was clear that they were going to, the Umayyad dynasty, they were going to get to a stage where there is nothing left to be called human rights, nothing left to be called human dignity, nothing left to be called justice. And in the midst of all this, you have Ali alayhi salam seeing all this happen in front of his eyes, being unfolded. Now, Amir al-Mu'mineen, he had to enforce equality and justice at the same time. So when Uthman himself was, his house was surrounded by people, and people trying to kill him, they prevented him from even having water to drink. Now, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, in one hand he has established justice. In another hand he has established equality. Well, that man needs to, live. And you can see how sensitive and delicate the situation is. If it was anyone beside Amir al-Mu'mineen being in that position, things would have went horribly wrong in the Muslim history. Let us take a short break, then we will continue, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, we are looking at justice from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam. On one hand, we had the Umayyad dynasty, or the Umayyad, at least the family, the relatives of the Uthman, trying to loot and, you know, create havoc in the Muslim world. And on the other hand, Ali alayhi salam was determined to enforce equality and justice with all his might. And on the other hand, these persons were keen to have the reins of government in their own hand and to possess such much wealth and property as possible. Well, that was their aim, right? This is what Muawiyah did. Between these two conditions, they acted like gamblers, hoping to seize an opportunity to bring about a revolution and consequently to appropriate all benefits to themselves, entertaining the worst passion and desires in their minds. This is exactly what was their aim. This is what they wanted. There is no doubt about the fact that the responsibility assumed by Imam Ali alayhi salam at that time were extremely difficult and enormous. Various reasons and circumstances had made Imam Ali alayhi salam face many difficulties which could not be overcome easily. The world of the time, or the world of that time, was topsy turvy. The conditions were, revolutionary was about to take place, and the events were frightening, and the possibilities of Ali alayhi salam were so great overcoming these difficulties. And the responsibilities of Ali alayhi salam were so great and burdensome that the Khalifa and the religion of Islam depend on them. By solving these problems and overcoming these difficulties, Imam Ali alayhi salam performed a task which made his qualities known to the world. The world came to know how mindful he was of the public's right, how determined he was to promote individual and collective virtues, and with what patience and perseverance he achieved his own objectives. It was a difficult time for Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi. Difficulties that were never faced by anyone before him, difficulties that were never faced by anyone after him. He is in the middle of a revolution that's about to take place, and Amir al-Mu'mineen has to make a choice, and obviously the right choice. He had to establish justice. And for what he did, 100 years after, he was cursed publicly on pulpits because he stood against the Umayyad dynasty. He stood against the oppressors. And after that, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, his justice echoed through history, whether they curse him or not. The justice of Ali echoes through history, and the world knew Ali for what he is, for what he really is, the greatest man that walked the face of this earth. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله.
In the limelight.
Messages between former U.S. Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and others suggest the former President Donald Trump White House coordinated efforts to stop Joe Biden's certification. We are prepared for you an article written by Hugo Lowell. The piece is titled U.S. Capitol Attack Panel Investigates Trump Over Potential Criminal Conspiracy. Select Committee investigating the Capitol attack is examining whether former U.S. President Donald Trump oversaw a criminal conspiracy on 6th of January that connected the White House's scheme to stop Joe Biden's certification with the insurrection. Two senior sources familiar with the matter say the committee's new focus on the potential for a conspiracy marks an aggressive escalation in its inquiry as it confronts evidence that suggests the former President Donald Trump potentially engaged in criminal conduct egregious enough to warrant a referral to the U.S. Justice Department. The sources said House investigators are interested in whether Donald Trump oversaw a criminal conspiracy after communications turned over by Trump's former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and others suggested the White House coordinated effort to stop Joe Biden's certification. The source said the Select Committee has several thousand messages, among which include some that suggest the Trump White House briefed a number of House Republicans on its plan for then-Vice President Mike Pence to abuse his ceremonial role and not certify Joe Biden's election win. The sources said the fact that the Select Committee has messages suggesting the Trump White House directed Republican members of Congress to execute a scheme to stop Joe Biden's certification is significant as it could give rise to the panel considering referrals for potential crimes. The sources noted members and counsel on the Select Committee are examining in the first instance whether in seeking to stop the certification, Donald Trump and his aides violated the federal law that prohibits obstruction of a congressional proceeding. The joint session on 6th of January. The sources said the Select Committee believes that Donald Trump may be culpable of an obstruction charge, given he failed for hours to intervene to stop the violence on the Capitol perpetrated by his supporters in his name. But the sources added the Select Committee is also looking at whether Donald Trump oversaw an unlawful conspiracy that involved coordination between the political elements of the White House plan communicated to Republican lawmakers and extremist groups that stormed the Capitol. That would probably be the most serious charge for which the Select Committee might consider a referral, as it considers a range of other criminal conduct that has emerged in recent weeks, from obstruction of justice to potential wire fraud by the GOP. The vice chair of the Select Committee, the Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney, referenced the obstruction charge when she read from the criminal code before members voted unanimously last November to recommend Mark Meadows in contempt of Congress for refusing to testify. The Guardian previously reported that Donald Trump personally directed lawyers and political operatives working from the Willard Hotel in Washington, D.C. to find ways to stop Joe Biden's certification from happening at all on 6th of January, just hours before the Capitol attack. But the sources said House investigators are yet to find evidence tying Donald Trump personally to the Capitol attack and may ultimately only recommend referrals for the straight obstruction charge, which has already been brought against around 275 rioters rather than for conspiracy. The U.S. Justice Department could yet charge Donald Trump and aides separate to the Select Committee investigation, but one of the sources said the panel, as of mid-December, had no idea whether the agency is actively examining potential criminality by the former president. A spokesperson for the House Select Committee declined to comment on details about the investigation. A spokesperson for the U.S. Justice Department declined to comment whether the agency had opened a criminal inquiry for Donald Trump and his closest allies over 6th of January. The sources said still the Select Committee appears to be moving towards making at least some referrals, or alternatively, recommendations in its final report that an aggressive prosecutor at the U.S. Justice Department could use to pursue a criminal inquiry. The Select Committee is examining the evidence principally to identify legislative reforms to prevent a repeat of Donald Trump's plan to subvert the election. The members say if they find Donald Trump violated federal laws, they have an obligation to refer that to the U.S. Justice Department. Sending a criminal referral to the U.S. Justice Department, especially a recommendation for prosecution, carries no formal legal weight, since Congress lacks the authority to force it to open a case, and House investigators have no authority to charge witnesses with a crime. But a credible criminal referral from the Select Committee could have a substantial political effect, given the importance of the 6th of January inquiry, and place pressure on the Attorney General Merrick Garland to initiate an investigation or explain why he might not do so. The sources said internal discussions about criminal referrals intensified after communications turned over by Mark Meadows revealed alarming lines of communication between the Trump White House and Republican lawmakers over 6th of January. In one exchange released by the Select Committee, one Republican lawmaker texted Mark Meadows an apology for not pulling off what might have amounted to a coup, saying 6th of January was a terrible day, not because of the attack, but because they were unable to stop Joe Biden's certification. The sources said the Select Committee believes messages such as that text, as well as remarks from a Republican on the House floor as the Capitol came under attack, might represent one part of a conspiracy by the White House to obstruct the joint session of the Congress. In referencing objections to six states, the text also appears to comport with a memo authored by the Trump lawyer John Eastman that suggested lodging objections to six states, raising the specter the White House distributed the plan more widely than previously known. Benny Thompson, the chairman of the Select Committee, added on ABC News recently that the investigation had found evidence to suggest the events of 6th of January appeared to be coordinated effort on the part of a number of people to undermine the election. Counsel for the Select Committee indicated in their contempt of Congress report for Mark Meadows that they intended to ask Donald Trump's former chief of staff about those communications he turned over voluntarily before he broke off a cooperation deal and refused to testify. One of the sources said Benny Thompson has also suggested to reporters that he believes Mark Meadows stopped cooperating with the inquiry in part because of pressure from Donald Trump. But the Select Committee has not opened a separate witness intimidation investigation into the former president.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are presently discussing about the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the sermons of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. At the moment, we are discussing the 16th sermon of Imam Ali alayhi salam, where Imam explains about the strategy of his governance. What was his strategy? What aim and what are those steps that he was following? What are his long-term aims? What is his method of execution and how he will execute? So basically, this is his timetable, his methodology, and he talks about the strategy that he's going to use, where firstly he comes as when he comes to Medina and he gives a lecture there, the first lecture, you can say the maiden speech, where he comes and explains his governance. He first of all talks about the fact that whatever he says is going to add a responsibility on him, and therefore his words are serious. And they are not just, time wasters. And he goes on to say, إِلَّا مَنْ صَرَّحَتْ لَهُ الْعِبَرُ عَمَّا بَيْنَ يَدَيْهِ مِنَ الْمَثُولَاتِ حَجَزَتْهُ التَّقْوَى عَنْ تَقَحُّمِ الشُّبُهَاتِ. That one who, for one who it is clear already, the lessons of the past, of course he will take the precautions and will stop himself from doing what is incorrect and falling into doubts.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam, there was a difference in the way Imam Ali alayhi salam handled the government and his method of governance, because his governance was based on the truth. This is because Imam Ali is the truth. Al-haqqu ma'a Ali, wal-Ali wa-Aliyun ma'al-haqq. Ali is with the truth. Rather, Ali, in a way, is the truth. Now, what is truth actually? The truth is that which is compatible with our creation. It is conforming with our natures and with the essence of the universe. This is what is true. Now, when we say that the legislation, a certain form of legislation, is true, a certain ruling, a certain method of governance is true, it is that type of method of governance that conforms that is compatible fully with the type of creation of the human beings, with the essence of the human beings and with the essence of the universe and with the ontological realities of the universe. So there is a complete conformity, a complete coordination, and a complete synchronicity that exists between that form of legislation and the creation of the universe. Those who legislate, form laws, postulate systems, political systems, methods of governance, methods of social coherence and structure, those who claim to do this and legislate the laws behind them and promote these systems and make these systems, while these systems are against the nature of the human beings, against the essence, or do not conform with the essence of the universe, do not conform with the ontological realities of the universe, they cannot claim to be bearers of true systems, true forms of legislation. While Imam Ali alayhi salam is one who claims to be a bearer of true, was of the true form of legislation.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, we therefore come to realize that Imam Ali alayhi salam is one who, when he legislates, when he brings about or he presents a political system, a methodology in leadership, and he brings about this form of legislation that postulating a certain form of system in governance, then he is claiming that this system is one which is true. And if it is supposed to be true, then it is supposed to be one which conforms totally with the essence of a human being, with the nature of a human being, and with the nature and essence of the universe. But now the question is that who else apart from God knows these ontological realities, who knows the creation, who knows the essence of this world, the essence of the human beings? It is only Allah, the one who created. أَلَا يَعْلَمُ مَنْ خَلَقَ. Isn't the one who created know his creation? Of course, Allah is the one, the best person to know the realities of the human essence and the realities of what he created, the realities of the universe. And that is why he is the most suitable person to legislate. And those who are attached to God, that have got authority from God, are attached to the knowledge of God, these are the ones that have the, you can say, they can claim to bring true legislation. Why? Because whatever they will legislate, whatever they will postulate as a political system, whatever they will bring about as a strategy of leadership, will be one which conforms totally with human creation and human essence. And therefore, when Imam Ali alayhi salam comes and claims and brings about this system, he knows that this system is true. It is based on truth, and it is something that is going to bring true perfection in the society and in the creation as a whole. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He helps us to understand these teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
من ناداه أول حضن يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On January 3, 2020, the United States assassinated Iran's Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani alongside the deputy commander of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Unit, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in a drone strike at the Baghdad airport.
When American democracy is a complete sham, as it was under Trump, and it reached its apotheosis, you could say, with the assassination of a great anti-ISIS fighter, really the main force that was fighting ISIS.
5 days later, Iran launched a barrage of ballistic missiles at Iraq's Ain al-Assad airbase housing U.S. troops in retaliation for the assassination, leaving scores of casualties. The Pentagon downplayed the number of troops injured in the strike, but later admitted that over 100 of its personnel suffered traumatic brain injuries. One died by suicide in October.
See, this is probably what Pompeo and Trump were counting on. They thought, we'll kill the Soleimani, and then maybe Iran will attack us, and that will give us an excuse to go to war against Iran. I'm sure that was their plan. You didn't do that. That was it's very wise. When you're dealing with an enraged bull, you don't poke it. You go around it, you figure out where its weak spots are, you do that kind of strategizing.
This is what the head of the United States Central Command has told a New Yorker journalist about the airstrike on Ain al-Assad airbase.
They hit pretty much where they wanted to hit. They can strike effectively across the breadth and the depth of the Middle East. They could strike with accuracy and they could strike with volume.
The American general has admitted that Iran's missile capabilities have given the Islamic Republic overmatch, a military term meaning a level of military prowess where the country can overwhelm the enemy by a significant margin. Last August, the Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan in a matter of weeks and seized control of the capital, Kabul, while the U.S. troops were still present in the country. Observers believe the United States' withdrawal from the Central Asian country will go down in history as one of the most chaotic moves Washington has ever made. But a senior commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says Americans will have to leave Iraq in a more humiliating manner than the way they left Afghanistan. The commander of the IRGC's Quds Force said the Americans are facing various problems in the region while a resistance front is advancing on a daily basis. Brigadier General Ismail Ghani noted that the resistance fighters are now equipped with missiles and weapons that can target U.S. warships anywhere in the region. The senior commander said Americans will be finally uprooted from the region. He made the remarks at a ceremony in the Iranian city of Mashhad on the second anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis.
I don't know. You ask if the U.S. has got the message. Well, sometimes people or nations are so foolish that they go to such a point with their mistaken agenda that it just collapses completely. So that seems to be what's going to happen. I don't know when it will happen, but there seems to be very little possibility of a rational U.S. government.
Despite the United States and its allies' repeated threats, Iran has proven its ability to make good on its promise to mete out a crushing response to any possible aggressor.
Just days into 2022, North Korea carried out a major weapons test. It launched a hypersonic missile this week, with North Korean media saying the projectile precisely hit its target at a distance of 700 kilometers. This was North Korea's second test of a hypersonic missile. Unlike ballistic missiles that fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory, hypersonic weapons fly at lower altitudes and can achieve more than five times the speed of sound. Analysts say, however, the main feature of hypersonic weapons is not their speed, but their maneuverability makes them much harder to detect by radar. The North is currently part of a small group of countries, including the United States and China, in trying to develop hypersonic military technologies.
They have a plan. They have a plan that is public. Is public. Is not. There is no secret. Is available. So they have several devices, several weapon range that they want to develop. And one category is the hypersonic one.
The latest test firing came days after North's leader Kim Jong-un pledged once again to boost Pyongyang's defenses. He said in a New Year's speech that Pyongyang would continue to strengthen its capabilities because the Korean Peninsula still faces an increasingly unstable military environment. North Korea tested different projectiles last year amid stalled talks with the United States and its southern neighbor. Under former U.S. President Donald Trump, America and North Korea came close to a conflict before a series of meetings between the two adversaries' presidents. The high-profile summits broke down with no agreement, making Trump's approach towards North Korea another one of his major failures. North Korea has been subjected to Western sanctions for decades. Its relationship with the U.S. and its southern neighbors, South Korea and Japan, both staunch American allies, has been fraught with tensions for a very long time. North Korea is grappling with economic sanctions and chronic food shortages. Pyongyang has suffered under sanctions, but it has somehow managed to withstand the American pressure campaign.
They manage to avoid any trouble to their economy in the same way that many other countries that are under sanction they're doing. So basically they readjust their economy in a way that they can survive.
Despite its long list of economic problems, the North has managed to produce several nuclear warheads, describing them as a necessary insurance against an attack by the U.S. The U.S., which has been calling on North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons, has left no stone unturned to isolate the communist state. But successive U.S. administrations have failed to force North Korea into submission. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration now says it is open to talks, but the North says that's implausible given the record of American hostile policies. The North seems too weary of American ulterior motives. What if it abandons its atomic arms and the U.S. does not drop its hostile policies and keeps up the pressure? This must be one of the key questions that comes to the North Korean leader's mind when he focuses on his country's relationship with America. The North insists that the White House has been determined to take and reluctant to give during past talks. It remains to be seen how Biden will act now to try to ease tensions on the Korean Peninsula.
A new report has warned about the rising threat of extremism in the United States. The report has been prepared by the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab. It says that 12 months after the attack on the Capitol by a pro-Trump mob, far-right groups were traced and arrested by police and federal authorities. But it says other groups have reorganized, often with an emphasis on local-level politics. It found that domestic extremist groups have recruited and spread their messages through culture war debates, including vaccines, race, and education. It says groups such as Proud Boys and QAnon conspiracy movement have re-emerged in recent months. They have made progress by shifting to alternative online platforms, embracing rhetoric to engage more broadly with the mainstream conservative base and engaging in new political activities, particularly public health and education issues at the local level. The report says extremist movements were filled with paranoia following the Capitol riot. It notes that members are suspicious of each other and law enforcement. That has discouraged many members from attending public events.
They morph into different forms and formations, but they tend to follow the same basic tenets, which are white nationalism. So whether we're talking about the Ku Klux Klan or the White Citizens Council or the Oath Keepers, white Southern Baptists or neo-Nazis, the American history is replete with these types of organizations.
These extremist groups have adopted smaller and less sophisticated platforms, and that made them vulnerable to data scrapes, breaches, and hacks. The report warns of the rise of far-wing influencers inside these alternative social media platforms and the dangers that they could bring. Far-right figures like the former top Trump aide Stephen Bannon have encouraged a precinct-by-precinct strategy. It refers to a ground-up approach that focuses on local politics.
In 2022, Ronald Reagan's so-called shining city on the hill has become exposed as a mirage, as the poor, the elderly, and people of color are still fighting in 2022 for one person, one vote.
The report comes as the U.S. prepares to remember the first anniversary of the Capitol Hill riot. During the January 6th riot, thousands of supporters of former President Donald Trump attacked police, vandalized the Capitol, and sent members of Congress and then Vice President Mike Pence running for their lives. Democrats have been arguing that the riot on January 6th was an insurrection based on disinformation spread by Trump, who alleges that he is the true victor of the 2020 presidential election and not Joe Biden.
As an economic system, based on unbridled capitalism, the system eventually has to implode. The insatiable lust for markets, the insatiable lust for resources and profits cannot be sustained.
A new poll has found that 60% of Americans believe Trump's level of responsibility for the attack was either a great deal or a good amount. Trump is often cited by U.S. media as the one inciting his supporters to storm the Congress premises in the hope of overturning the election results. A committee tasked with investigating the events of the January 6th riot has issued dozens of subpoenas to Trump's current and former associates.
These folks are well-funded, they are very well-organized, but I don't think that they are in large enough numbers to where they can really take over the government in the manner in which, you know, in terms of a civil war and that kind of thing. I think that's a bit rhetorical. I think that's a bit of hyperbole.
At least seven.